class about Noah and the flood. And we've talked about all the topics you see on that list down to today's date. And today is November 23rd, I think, isn't it? Still is. Okay. And we're talking today about when did the flood happen? We're trying to build your faith and the confidence of what you read when you read the Bible, especially the Old Testament. Jesus took the flood and the story of Noah and the ark as history. We talked about it a couple of times. And the writers of the New Testament, particularly Peter, had a lot to say about it. And we'll get to some verses like that perhaps later on in our study. But it was history, although it happened a long, long time ago. Now, the Bible doesn't give us dates in the scriptures. We don't have, when an event happens, we don't have in the writing itself, this happened in 2400 BC or whatever, because, of course, there wasn't any date keeping like that in those days. And even in the New Testament, how did they tell you when something happened? Well, it happened in the reign of a certain emperor or a certain king. And so there are some notations given in the scripture to tell you when things happened. But when you go back in the Old Testament, particularly the early chapters of Genesis, we just simply don't have any information. And you say, well, wait a minute. In my King James Bible, at the top of chapter 1, verse 1 of Genesis, it says, when did that happen? Well, it says in the original King James, and I don't know if they've dropped this in the more recent versions, but it says 4004 BC, right? That was a date that stuck in a lot of people's minds because it was there in the margin of their Bibles, and I don't have any idea where it came from. But it came from a bishop, Usher, who sat and did a calculation that we'll talk about in a few minutes. And came to the conclusion that that's when it happened. And further refinement said it happened on October the 29th at 10 o'clock in the morning. I don't know where he got that kind of information or who figured that out. But anyway, that's one opinion. It's not something that's in the scripture itself. Well, we're going to look at that and see if we can. There's other evidence that we can look at apart from the scriptures that give us some information based upon something that God said in the scriptures. So that's what we're going to look at this morning. And it's a fairly complex discussion, and so I want you to kind of stick with me because some of these things, I'll skip the rather esoteric parts of it, but and just say, you know, you wave your arms and say, this is how it is. And so we'll do that at the appropriate times. But I'll tell you when we're talking about conjecture, and when we have fairly solid evidence, and we do, curiously. We have an ark sitting at 6,000 feet in the Ararat Mountains. We've talked about that. We've talked about what's been learned about it without digging it up, because the Turkish government doesn't want anybody working on it who's not qualified to do so, and I guess they've had trouble finding people who are willing to risk their careers in examining that, because it's sort of anathema to the evolutionists. But nonetheless, it's there, and there's plenty of evidence that it's real, and there's plenty of evidence that it is the ark, that it's Noah's ark. And so now we're going to look at that, and there are some things we can do and some things we can't do. Ideally, we would like to dig that thing up and find some wood or something in it and do a carbon-14 dating on it, but it's turned to rock. It's petrified. And because it's petrified, there's that kind of a measurement is not going to be accurate. So, how are we going to do this? Okay. We're going to look at the story in Genesis first. Well, now what happened to my slide? You saw, well, okay, that one, there it is. There we go. You've seen this slide before, and it's on the back of your paper, right? No, there's one like it on the back of your paper, but not this one. This is the one taken from Genesis 5, where there is a genealogy given for the descendants of Adam. Okay? And we looked at that and said, that looks to be a real genealogy. It looks to be accurate. And as it turns out, the flood, where the flood occurred, both Lamech and Methuselah, who didn't make it on the boat, as we noted before, and for perfectly good reasons. Lamech died about 5 years before the flood, and Methuselah was probably the last righteous person to die before the flood. And in the year that he died, the flood was sent. And that has to do with his name, because it means he died and it is sent. That's what that long name means. So it looks to be internally consistent. Only Noah and Shem in that reading are the ones who survived the flood, and we know why. They were on Noah's ark. So we said, there's one other reason why this genealogy we think is accurate, and that's because these people lived so long, had dozens of children, and by the time the flood came, there were billions of people on the earth. And if you want to know that argument, you can go back and listen to that particular lesson. Those are recorded on the website, and you can download the audio part and listen to the discussion there. All right, now, last week, or was it 2 weeks ago, we talked about this diagram where we have Noah, his three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and this is in the 10th chapter and the 11th chapter of Genesis, where it talks about all the different nations that came from the descendants of Noah. That all mankind was derived from this one man and his three sons and their wives. So, there are some interesting things about this. You might notice this particular lineage here, where we have a name, after Arphaxad, we have a name in italics, Canaan. And then Shelah, Eber, and we're going to follow down Peleg, Reu, Serug, Nahor, and Terah to Abram. And so this genealogy is given to connect Abram with Noah, to show that there is a connection. And of course, you could connect every living human being, if you knew the details, to Noah, because he was the father of all of them, he and his wife. So why is that? Why is Canaan, now this is spelled differently from the word Canaan, the land. See, this is C-A-I-N-A-N. Why is it in italics? Well, in the versions that you're reading, it isn't there. But if you look in the Septuagint, it is there, with the ages of the father when the son Shelah was born, and the age of Arphaxad when Canaan was born. So when you look at Luke, the third chapter, you'll find this genealogy there, and Canaan is included. But he's not included in your NIV, which is based on a different series of Hebrew manuscripts. It doesn't make any difference in what I'm about to say, but it is kind of interesting that names are omitted in these genealogies from time to time, and they're not completely consecutive. So we're going to talk about that. We'll look at this one through Arphaxad, which is probably the strangest name on the whole screen. 2 years after the flood, when Shem was 100 years old, he became the father of Arphaxad. Now, he was born after the flood, you see. And Shem lived another 500 years. But it doesn't tell us, like in Genesis 5, it doesn't sum those two numbers, is really all it has to do, and say the total of his life was how long? Can you do the simple addition there? Everybody? Or has everybody already gone to sleep? Okay. 600 years would be his total lifespan, wouldn't it? Okay, so we have the information to make a diagram like we saw before. And when Arphaxad lived 35 years, became the father of Shelah, and after he became the father of Shelah, he lived 403 years. So his total lifespan was 438 years. But that information is calculable, but it isn't given the way it was in Genesis 5. And I suspect that these genealogies had been collected, and when Moses put all of this together, he had those genealogies, perhaps from separate sources. Maybe God gave it to him. We don't really know. We weren't there when he wrote it down. So we can put together a diagram like the one that we had for Adam and his descendants, but there's some peculiar things about it. I put Canaan in here. We do have some numbers about when Shelah was born, how old he was, and then how long he lived after Shelah was born. So here's a diagram, but there's a peculiar thing that we talked about, Peleg. Why is Peleg unusual? Because his name means division, and when he was named Peleg, because in his time, what happened? The earth was divided. Okay, so Peleg is special, and so in his time, it says, the earth was divided. Well, look at that. Diagram this way. It was in the time of every man in that whole list till you get to Abraham. So when was the earth divided, you see? What is their peculiar? Why would it be in Peleg's time and not in Reu's time or in Arphaxad's time or even in Shem's time for that matter, that the earth was divided? So the reason, I think, is this. 2 years after the flood, when Shem was 100 years old and so on, when Arphaxad had lived 35 years, became the father of Shelah. See? Now, the word father is used in these genealogies also means the ancestor. And the word son, when it's used in these genealogies, also means the descendant. And you can see that in some other genealogies in the Bible. So we'll change father to ancestor, and we don't do any damage to what the Hebrew means. Now, there's some examples of that. If you look in Matthew 1, verses 1 to 3, you have the genealogy of who? Whom? Jesus, right. It is whom, isn't it? Not who. Okay, so it begins with what I call a summary genealogy. A record of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Because those were the two important links between Jesus and Abraham. Why was it important that Jesus be the son of Abraham? Because of the promise in Genesis 12 that there are our community Bible study has been looking at on Thursday morning. If you had the chance to come to that, you ought to come. That's an interesting study. The promise was that the seed of Abraham would bless how many nations of the earth? All of them. Right. So that's important. Why was it important that he be the son of David? Well, the promise had been made to David that he would have a son who would have a kingdom that would never end. So there's an importance to these linkages, you see. And then the writer, Matthew, goes ahead to list all of the names in between Abraham and David. He lists 14 generations there. Then he lists 14 more between David and the time of the Babylonian captivity, and then 14 more generations between the captivity and the birth of Jesus. Now, the fact that he breaks that genealogy down into sections of 14 at a time is kind of suspicious too. It sounds like he was making it, giving it some sort of a basis for memorization. And in fact, if you look at what's in Matthew 1, at the genealogy from the time of the captivity in Babylon down to the time of Jesus, and go back and compare that with 1 Chronicles, the third chapter, you'll find that there's several names that are omitted. So there's the possibility that names are left out. And so perhaps this genealogy that we saw, that we put together in this diagrammatic way so that we can see how much time passed between the flood, for example, and the birth of Abram, which Bishop Usher thought was about 1850 B.C. It actually turns out to be more like 2150, but if you do a very careful analysis. But then he would have guessed, see, these are years from creation, and so he would have guessed that creation was about 4000 B.C. But maybe that genealogy is not complete. Maybe it is a representative genealogy that can be expanded like that. And then something happening in the time of Peleg doesn't happen in the life of Eber. It doesn't happen in the life of Reu, although it continues. The separation of the continents started in the time of Peleg when the continents were divided. I think that's what we're talking about here, but I'm going to tell you outright that it's an opinion of mine that's what we're talking about. So we can't look at those dates and names and lengths of life is what I'm talking about until the next son was born. We can't look at those numbers and add them all up and say, okay, the flood happened in 2500 B.C. And actually, that's clearly not the case anyway. So when did it happen? How are we going to find out when did the flood happen? You can say, well, the ark is petrified wood. How long does it take for the wood to petrify? Well, that really doesn't take very long. A few centuries can do that. So we can't measure any of the wood in the ark. We can't get to any of the wood in the ark that's not petrified where we could make a measurement. So we can't do the obvious things. We have to look at something else. And there was a verse of scripture that I told you to drive a peg on. That's one of Ken's favorite comments. Put a peg on this particular verse of scripture in Genesis 8:22. As long as the earth endures, this is a promise that God made to Noah. Seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night will never cease. Now what I'm going to tell you doesn't depend upon whether or not there was summer and winter before the flood, although there's pretty good evidence in the scripture that the earth was uniformly warm before the flood, and now after the flood, we got summer and winter. So summer and winter leaves its effects in our world. Can we tell how many summers and winters there have been since the flood? And curiously, there are ways to get at that. And so we're going to spend a few minutes looking at some science I think I can explain it clearly enough to you that you can understand why we're going to make the comments that we do. Okay. So, first of all, we'll talk about tree rings. This is a cross-section of a tree. And as a matter of fact, I think all of you have seen lots of cross-sections of trees in the last couple of months, haven't you? Did you stop and count the rings in any of the tree trunk sections that you saw? That's an interesting thing to do. I did. Some of these trees were 70 or 80 years old. A few of them were over 100 years old, these pine trees particularly, that got cut down because of the storm. So you can cut a tree across its trunk and measure the rings, but you don't have to kill the tree to make this measurement. And that's what this soda straw on the right-hand side over here is about. There's a tool that you can core into the trunk of a tree and pull out a core that tells you how many rings the tree has without killing the tree. And as soon as you pull that out, I'm reassured by some tree people, the tree puts some sap into the hole and seals it up and goes on about its business. It doesn't say ouch when you do this. Okay. So we can get the kind of measurements I'm going to tell you about here without killing the trees. Some trees live pretty long. What would you guess would be the oldest tree in North America? If you've ever been to California and you looked at the redwood, sequoia redwood, you would guess that they're pretty old, and indeed they are. They're hundreds of years old. But they're not the oldest trees. So let's look for older trees. Here's how you tell how old a tree is. If you get the tree ring, like the cross-section that we had, and this one is labeled, it was harvested in 1992, and so we know that it made its first appearance as a sprout in 1958. You can count the rings around the center of it as you go out. And you'll notice some interesting things about the rings. the rings aren't all the same darkness. Some of them are darker than others. I've indicated that by arrows here. And some are very, very thin and tenuous and difficult to see, like the one in 1974. And others are very, very dark, like the one in 1977. And the space between the rings is different. Some of them are wide and some of them are narrow. And all of this business about the rings and how wide and how spaced the rings are depends upon the weather. And so when the tree goes through a year that is cool and dry in the summer, winter, spring, summer, and fall, the clear space between the rings is very small. And when it's wet and warm, it's very large. The ring is darker in a hard winter, and it's lighter when the winter is mild. And so you can make kind of a barcode out of these rings. And if you look at a series of trees grown in one region, you'll find that you can identify the same set of rings in each of the trees. And so it's that precise. This science is called dendrochronology. And as you can see, we're counting years. Now, if we had a tree that lived 30,000 years or something like that, you could go through and look at its rings and see what the weather was like. And certainly, the year of the flood was a year of unusual weather. Okay, so we can expect to see something if we had a tree that old, but we don't. The oldest trees in North America are in the White Mountains of California. It's called a bristlecone pine tree. It's not a very, maybe you think it's dramatic looking, because most of it is dead, but it has a few branches that still have leaves on it. It lives in one of the most harsh environments that you could imagine, not a very long growing season, but it endures a winter that's really very bad most of the time, so the rings are pretty dark. I don't have any pictures of their particular rings, but they look just like rings in other trees, except for the fact that it grows 1 inch of rings in a century. So it doesn't get very big either, does it? You don't have a scale there to look, but most of those limbs are thicker than your leg. Now, they've taken borings from these trees, and these trees are in a protected area where they can't be damaged. They're, at least no one's supposed to go and do any damage to them. And around the trees are old logs that are older than the living logs. Okay? There are tree logs there that are no longer attached to the tree. Nothing ever happens to them because there aren't any termites living at this altitude. So they sit there for a long, long time. And there has been a chronology of the years from the rings in this kind of tree that goes back to about 6,000 BC. It does away with Usher's chronologies. There's been summer and winter for 8,000 years or so, at least. It could be longer than that. We just don't have the trees to tell about that. So there we have one way of telling there have been summer and winter for a long, long time. Now, we need to diverge here and digress slightly about carbon-14 dating is what I'm looking for. Let me get a drink. All of you, I think, know in this age of atomic energy that we live in a world where we're exposed to some radioactivity. Some of you worry about the radon emitting radiation in your kitchen sink. But actually, it's the not the sink, but the countertop. Rocks have radiation in them, and so you're exposed to a certain amount of radioactivity, but your body has a mechanism for healing any damage that it does. And in fact, we're bombarded from outer space with cosmic radiation all the time. But you manage to endure most of that. Some of it does indeed cause cause mutations and give us trouble later in life. But most of the time, it doesn't really bother us unless you're exposed to a really big dose. The astronauts who go into outer space are exposed to maybe 100 times the dose that we are, and they have to be careful to shield themselves and to not stay too long and that sort of thing. And that's a problem when we talk about traveling to Mars and back or something like that. One of the isotopes of carbon is radioactive. Now, our bodies are made up of carbon. You're a carbon mechanism, really. Scientists study life, and particularly medicine, they figured out most of the kinds of proteins in your body, the enzymes that make you alive, and they're made out of carbon. So there's a lot of carbon in you. And carbon also makes diamonds, of course. It takes many different forms. But you are the carbon that you have eaten. In other words, you take carbon in by eating plants and animals. And animals take carbon in by eating plants or other animals. The plants take carbon in and make their bodies and all of their chemicals and their existence by photosynthesis. And photosynthesis is a completely different mechanism. It takes carbon out of the air in the form of carbon dioxide. So a plant growing in your garden is taking in air and taking the carbon dioxide out of the air. That's interesting as we discuss trying to get rid of the carbon dioxide that's rising in our atmosphere. It's not a large proportion, but the amount of carbon dioxide in our atmosphere is rising slowly with time because we're burning a lot of fossil fuels and putting more carbon dioxide into the air than is taken out by the plants. And certainly when we cut down the rainforests and that sort of thing, we're damaging our planet's ability to remove the carbon dioxide. So the air contains carbon dioxide, and a small proportion of the carbon dioxide contains carbon atom, which is different from the ordinary carbon. The ordinary carbon is carbon 12, which I've made it yellow. And there's a scattering of atoms of carbon 14. Now, the carbon 14 is made by a complex process because of the impinging cosmic radiation on our atmosphere. It damages the atmosphere, and one of the products that comes out of that is a shower of neutrons, which are part of the particles in atoms, and they hit the nitrogen in our atmosphere and convert an occasional atom into carbon. Nitrogen is just one step above carbon in its weight. So we get some carbon 14 formed in our atmosphere, and it reacts with the oxygen in our atmosphere to make carbon dioxide. Now, as you breathe in and out in your lungs, you're taking in radioactive carbon dioxide, but there's so little of it that you don't have to worry about it at all. One atom in every million atoms of carbon dioxide is radioactive. But it's enough that can be measured very accurately if you have the right equipment. And so there was a doctor in the 1940s, who figured out this scheme that involves a measurement of living things that archaeologists dig up. So here's how it works. As long as you're alive, you're eating plants and animals that are inhaling radioactive carbon dioxide in this very tiny fraction, and in equilibrium with it. And so the same proportion in your tissues is carbon 14, as is in the atmosphere. That's one assumption. It turns out to be true. But as soon as a living organism dies, the amount of carbon 14 is no longer eating, you see, no longer assimilating food. The amount of carbon 14, as opposed to the total carbon content, begins to drop. And so every 5,500 years up here, half of the carbon 14 disappears from what used to be a living organism. And in another 5,500 or so years, they're still debating as to the exact number of years, Dr. Libby was the guy who won the Nobel Prize for figuring this out in 1960. But he thought it was 5,568 years. They now think it's 5,752 years, something like that. It's not enough to make much difference. Anyway, as the carbon-14 disappears, if you can measure the amount of it, it gradually fades away, and after 50% of it, you see, is gone, and another 50% is gone, and if we go another 5,000 years, another 50% is gone, and so if you look at the ratio of carbon-14 to carbon-12, you can tell how long it's been disintegrating since the organism died. Since a tree died, since a fossil died, if you've got a good carbon sample from a mummy in Egypt, and that sort of thing has been done many times now. Well, Dr. W.F. Libby was working on this procedure, and he realized what this meant, and so he got a series of samples of known age, and so he looked at, here's Ptolemy. I think they may have something from his tomb. Maybe it's a mummy. Here's some redwood from California. Here's some tree rings. Now, you can take a ring out of a tree trunk and chip out that ring. That ring died when it was formed. The rings in the center of a log are not alive, even though the tree's alive. The live part of a tree is in this right underneath the bark. And that keeps growing out as rings are formed. And so the center part of a log is older in carbon-14 dating than the outer portion, especially those that live for hundreds or thousands of years. And so we'll talk about that in a minute. But here's some dates for things that had been determined by chronological studies in Egypt, particularly because they have good records. And so he took all of these and predicted what their radioactive carbon-14 ratio ought to be. And sure enough, they fall upon the line pretty much. And he counted this as a confirmation of his concept. Now, there's an assumption about this that is sort of hidden if you don't think about it. And that is that the amount of carbon-14 in our atmosphere has always been the same. And that was the assumption at the start, but now we know that wasn't the case. And the way they found that out was by taking tree rings that were of known ages, because you could count the rings and see how old the tree trunk was, and go back and look at those. And when they now in modern times, as they've done these particular studies, they found that the actual age as measuring the tree rings follows this curve, whereas the predicted age looking at carbon-14 dating is along this line. So if you had a sample, say sample E, and you measured its uncorrected radiocarbon date, you would calculate that it was this age, when actually it's about 600 years older. Well, that means that the amount of carbon-14 in the atmosphere has been changing. It's getting higher and higher as time goes on. And it's being formed not because we've set off an atomic bomb or anything. It's being formed because over historic time, the cosmic radiation levels have changed, apparently. So anyway, they make this correction now, and they give out a corrected date based on the carbon-14 dating. That becomes important in another way to tell how old the ark is in just a minute.
Hello?
Yeah.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
With this correction, would there still be an assumption made that the increase was at an even rate?
Well, that's what the tree ring carbon-14 dating tells you, is that there has been an increase in the amount of carbon-14. So it looks to be younger than it really is, because in the past, Have I got that backward? Is it decreasing or it's changing? Anyway, we'll figure that one out. It's difficult to follow, but I wanted you to see that there's a correlation between carbon-14 dating, and they have gone back and checked it by looking, counting the rings in a tree and seeing how radioactive the rings are. That's the main point. Okay, we'll figure that out. Don't have time to do that right now. But anyway, now there's a similar way to do that. The tree ring data only carried us back to about 9,000, that is 7,000 BC, 9,000 years ago. As we talk about ages, BC, you recall, began 2,000 years ago, as we stand now, actually 2007 or so. But anyway, you have to add 2,000 years to the BC date in order to get the total date, and that carbon-14 dating is calibrated based on a 1950 date. I don't know why they don't change that to a 2,000-year date now, but for our purposes, it doesn't make any difference. But there's another way that there is banding that represents summer and winter. And this one is most interesting. It's like tree ring dating, but it's in the sediment in the bottom of lakes. Now, not just any lake. You can't go out to Lake Houston and do this. But the lakes and mountains have a very peculiar banding that are called varves, V-A-R-V-E-S. And the way that works is that there are glaciers in the mountains. This is particularly in the northern climes. The glaciers melt in the summer and freeze solid in the winter. Okay, that makes sense. We can understand that. When they're melting, they're carrying debris into the lake. And so in the summertime, this is summer, the melting snow and ice carries debris into the lake, and it's a mixture of fine and coarse particles. But because the lake is stirred by the wind, only the coarse particles settle to the bottom and the fine particles stay suspended. Okay? But then in the wintertime, when the lake freezes over, the wind has no effect on the water. And so the fine particles also settle out on top of the coarse particles that represented a summer. And so what they call an icing here, the black lines, make a band in the lake on top of the coarse particles. So you have alternating coarse and fine, coarse and fine, coarse and fine, that represents summer and winter. So maybe we can tell something there. And actually, it's most interesting here because this does tell us when the flood was. You would assume, even if there were summer and winter before the flood, that the flood itself, that year in which the words in the Hebrew, the earth was scoured, would have washed the sediment out of these lakes. And in fact, the mountains and the lakes formed after the flood, some of them at least. And so here we have, on the bedrock, the first layers laid down in the summers and winters following the flood, and with time, more and more of them build up. So they come along with a boat and a coring device again, just like coring the tree. They core the bottom of the lake all the way down to bedrock and pull that core very carefully out of the lake and open it up. It's sort of semi-solid. It's sort of like working with a Jell-O or something like that. You have to be careful not to tear it up. But very careful removal of the cores from a number of lakes in places like Switzerland and Sweden, Norway, and in Canada. All tell the same story. You can count the number of lines in the core. And you can also take samples from the different bands and measure the carbon-14 in them because they contain some biological material. And that tells the same story. That the lakes began accumulating sediment 13,000 years ago in 11,000 BC. And there have been continuous summer, winter since then. And that's a long, long time ago. That's much longer than we would have expected from the biblical record. But when you stop and think about it, The population of humanity didn't build up as rapidly after the flood as it had before the flood, because they're living now in a harsh environment. They don't live as long as they did, and don't have as many children. And a lot of them get killed by the weather and lightning strikes and storms and snowstorms and hailstorms. And so there's a lot more danger from the environment than there was before. So 13,000 years ago seems to be the date of the flood. Now that's not on October the 29th at 10 o'clock in the morning, but it gives you a rough idea that it was a long time ago, and that's contrary to what we've thought until just recently. Okay. Now, the rest of this goes by pretty quick. We're just about out of time, but it's going to work out just about right. Now, another clue comes from the fact that there were giant animals in the past. We talked about in gathering the animals, God sent to the ark the things that he wanted preserved, and where he had a choice, he probably didn't send to Noah the biggest of whatever it was. He's sending kinds of animals. And I don't know if any of you have seen any of these before. They're not in our zoos. If you stood a man up beside this thing, he's just about as tall as a man. A giant armadillo, effectively, is what that is. There were two versions of it. One of them had a big club on its tail, and the other one didn't. I think I'd prefer to come in contact with that one. This thing swung that thing around and could do some damage, couldn't he? Those are big animals, probably as large as a good-sized hippopotamus. This thing right here is a giant sloth. He stands about 10 feet tall. And so he lived in trees. He was very slow moving, but he didn't have very many people that bothered him because he had those big vicious claws that he could swipe at you with. And so these animals all disappeared in 11,000 BC. How do we know that? Well, carbon-14 dating of the remains of these animals, we don't see them any younger than that, any more recent than that, and we see their remains older than that. And there's one particular animal that I want to talk about, not this one, though. We mentioned that before. I wanted to show you the Irish elk that had 8 to 10 foot span on his antlers. And this animal, though a giant animal, outlived the flood because he lived until historic times. I think about 3,000, 2,000 years ago, these were found in northern England. But he had to really have good neck muscles to hold up that 200-pound rack. But the most interesting animal is the woolly mammoth. And I want to tell you a short story about the woolly mammoth. Woolly mammoths died out around 11,000 B.C., 13,000 years ago. And you'll find stories on the History Channel and the various science channels on your cable TV trying to explain how this happened. In fact, there was one they showed many times last year of going to dig up one of these mammoths and to study it, trying to recover an intact one, hopeful that they could get some DNA from it and maybe reconstruct a woolly mammoth someday for our zoos. That's a little far-fetched, but it could happen. And in fact, scientists, I think, recently think they have almost all of the woolly mammoth's genome to compare with modern elephants. This thing is about twice the size of an elephant. Modern-day African elephant could almost walk underneath him. These are huge animals. They lived in the northern climes, and there were big herds of them at the time of the flood, just before they died out, grazing on tropical vegetation in the Arctic regions of our world. It wasn't cold at the time. We know that because you can examine the stomach contents of the remains of these animals. We don't see just skeletons of them. These things are frozen solid in the ice. And they dug them out of the ice. And there are several examples historically. And they've got some of them in freezers now, trying to preserve them and study them carefully. In their stomachs is tropical vegetation. They were eating things that grow in our world, not the sparse plants of the Arctic regions. The Arctic was warm at the time. And the curious thing about them, there are thousands of them. Some of them were discovered by the early Arctic explorers, and they dug them out and chopped them up and fed the meat to their dogs. And still nutritious, or at least the dogs didn't really report whether it tasted very good. But they were hungry enough that they ate it, and it was still good. It was frozen, quick frozen meat. Now, the interesting thing about that is you can't take a woolly mammoth if we had one. You can't even take a large African elephant or an Indian elephant and freeze it quickly enough with modern refrigeration to preserve the stomach contents. By the time the heat within the animal, by the time he finally cools down, the digestive processes have already proceeded in his stomach. Something killed these animals by the thousands, huge herds of them, and buried them in ice. Now that's a curious mystery, but it has a bearing on our story about the flood when we talk in a couple of weeks about the mechanisms of the flood. How do you quick freeze a mammoth? And you have to suddenly bury him in super cold ice and snow, not just at freezing temperatures. We're talking minus 300 degrees or so. We got to get it way, way down and cool in order to cool him quickly enough to preserve him. And so they've been carbon 14 dated, and they do date to 11,000 BC. And there's been a smaller version of the woolly mammoth found on an island off the northeastern coast of Russia, where there apparently were a herd of these living on the island in isolation, pretty much. But they were midgets compared to these animals. I suspect they were ones that God had sent on the ark. And so they got let out after the ark, and they managed to survive for a while. It seems they died out about 3,000 or 4,000 years ago. But they may have lived into more recent historic times. I'm not sure. I haven't seen the latest about that. Okay, Dan has a question.
Are there any theories as to why these animals would have existed? Apparently equipped
for cold, not. Yeah, I don't know why that is. I don't know why. They may have come from a world that was cooler before the time when man was put on the earth, and we don't know that that all happened in consecutive days. We talked about that before. Okay, Chris has a question.
Why should we believe carbon 14 dates to 11,000 and not to 2 million? Why is it good for us? Why do we put faith in it up to 11,000 years and not for?
Because once you go through 5 or 6 half lives, there's no carbon 14 left. So you can't date anything any older than about 50,000 years ago. And so they're pretty sure that's okay. Unless you want, in order to defeat the concept here, you have to propose physical processes that are different from what we see in our world. And scientists, you see, when you're talking to a scientist, he doesn't believe that it's all changed. You might say, well, God changed it or planted the animals with this carbon 14. I don't think that's the case at all. I think we're looking at clues that have been left that can tell us some things about this whole story. But it is an old story, as my conclusion from the evidence that we see here. Now, next week, we're going to look at what I think the book of Revelation says about the flood. And you might be surprised, but there are several chapters that I put in your schedule there that you can read and see how that fits the story as we've unfolded it from Genesis, that when God went to review history in the book of Revelation, he tells us the same thing. He never mentions the word flood, but everything else in there suggests that that's what he's talking about. You had a question.
Of course, it's been a tribute, but you were talking about how many thousands were killed at the same time. My
came from those animals. Yeah, people were harvesting their tusks. You can see they have beautiful tusks. And a lot of ivory came from there, and it was perfectly good ivory, quick frozen. That's right. There are assumptions. It's nitrogen. No, you're just measuring absolute radioactivity. That's done only by counting the particles and eliminating the cosmic rays that come through the sample. And so it's been worked out and checked pretty. I think the fact that they checked it with tree ring data says that they're doing it right. Now, you can argue about a few hundred years plus or minus, but actually the basic concept of carbon-14 dating I think is correct. Now, but it's a surprise as to how long ago this was. And we're going to look at that some more, and you may have some more questions about that. But we have assumed some things from reading our Bible that probably were not true. Okay. Thank you. Our time is gone, and there are going to be some other people who want to use the auditorium in a minute.